used to tell me I was building a dream.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking.
On March 12, 1933, 8 days after his first inauguration, President Franklin D. Roosevelt gave a nationwide radio address. In what is usually considered the first of his legendary fireside chats, FDR tried to soothe the nation's fears. University at Albany professor of history Richard Ham.
In 1933, the nation was in a shambles. The economy was collapsed. Over 5,000 banks would fail in the early years of the Great Depression.
Buddy, can you spare a dime?
Let us unite in banishing fear. We have provided the machinery to restore our financial system, and it is up to you to support and make it work. It is your problem, my friend. Your problem no less than it is mine. Together, we cannot fail.
University at Albany Professor of Communication Michael Barbaric.
The primary purpose in the beginning of the Fireside Chats was really to establish a relationship between the president and the people, and the main thrust of that relationship was to deliver confidence to the people.
Dear President, it gave me great pleasure to hear your voice over the radio on Sunday night. For what you have accomplished since you have taken office was never done by no other man that was ever in the White House. For it was a godsend for the way the people suffered this winter, when you have to sit in your house and cannot get coal. I could not buy a bit of coal in 2 months. And I'm not the only one. There are thousands of others. But thank God the time has come at last when we've got a man like you to save us from any more suffering. For as God had sent Moses to deliver his chosen people out of the land of bondage, so also, I think, he sent you to free us from the hands of a lot of robbers like Wall Street. I'm wishing you a long and prosperous life to yourself and family from a friend.
Such listener responses were quite common. Michael Barbaric.
They wrote him letters. They sent them telegrams. And so they felt that they had this relationship with the president that I think was fairly unusual and new in the American experience.
But for people in New York State, the relationship was not a new one. They'd heard FDR on the air before. He'd spent the previous 4 years crafting and refining his broadcasting skills while serving as state governor.
Dear President Roosevelt, my husband and I are happy because you've decided to continue the policy you adopted while at Albany of speaking to the people over the air.
Other presidents had given speeches on radio, but they had just done that. It was just basically a broadcast of a public speech. And the problem with that is that they didn't adapt to the medium.
My fellow citizens, this broadcast tonight marks the beginning of the mobilization of the whole nation.
Richard Ham.
Herbert Hoover made 95 broadcasts between 1929 and 1933. Yet we don't remember Herbert Hoover's broadcasts, and FDR's broadcasts have become landmarks in our history, in part because FDR was just a lot better at fitting the medium and the message together than Hoover ever was. FDR's message got through because he actually studied the medium and worked at it, and he knew what he was doing when he was giving those speeches.
As the lucky strike magic carpet pauses again in Buffalo, we swing into the dance with the candy parade and paradise.
When Roosevelt became governor in 1929, radio was still fairly new. For listeners, picturing the unseen was a fascinating experience. Michael Barbaric.
It forces you to imagine. And that practice makes radio an extremely powerful medium because it affects your cognitive and emotional sensibilities much more than, you know, sitting in front of television where all of that's fairly defined for you.
Marie LaPaglia is a lifelong Albany resident who was 10 years old at the start of the Great Depression. She says that the family radio was an important part of her home.
Well, that was it. There was no television. That was our pleasure, was our radio. Everybody had a radio. That was a part of your life. Radio took you out of your surroundings. It made you forget that you were poor.
Radio brought the family together. They found the radio to be a communal experience.
Hey, I'll go wandering through dreamland with my head among the stars.
In the capital region of New York State, the air first miraculously crackled to life on February 20th, 1922.
This is radio station WGY in Schenectady. W for wireless, G for General Electric, and Y for the last letter in our city.
General Electric's flagship station, WGY, was the first in the country to broadcast at 50,000 watts. By 1925, WGY had created the first upstate radio network by linking with stations in Syracuse, Rochester, and Buffalo. WGY's network offered Governor Roosevelt a solution to political problems. Michael Barbrick.
In April of 1929, he delivered his first radio report to the people of New York. And these were meant to be annual addresses where he would speak plainly about the situation in New York and basically explain what the legislature was doing and what they had promised to do. And if they weren't doing what they had promised to do, then basically he was saying, well, you know, why don't we goad them along to actually get some of this stuff done?
In her memoirs, Roosevelt's personal secretary recalled FDR's decision to speak directly to New Yorkers.
Fed up with the pulling and hauling of customary political bargaining, he declared curtly, I'll take the issue to the people. He did, by radio over a New York State chain, and the results were immediate. Mail came flooding into Albany, most of it in support of the Roosevelt position, and most of it addressed to the working level of the legislature. It was a convincing demonstration. And from that time on, FDR made it a more or less regular practice to take his problems to the people in this manner. Grace Tully.
Samuel Rosenman helped write the speeches.
From time to time, during each session of the legislature, he delivered a very simple, direct, chatty radio talk in which he told the people of the state what was currently going on in Albany and appealed to them in his fight with the legislature. A flood of letters would deluge the members of the legislature after each talk, and they were the best weapon Roosevelt had in his struggles for legislation. Samuel Rosenman.
It's important to remember that American politics in this period is a machine-driven system.
Richard Hamm.
That you have urban political machines and you have state political machines. And Roosevelt was engaged in many, many patronage struggles with them and policy struggles with these machines. And Roosevelt would bypass them. He would speak directly to the people through radio. And this kind of direct speaking to the people worked very effectively because the people really thought Franklin Roosevelt was talking to them.
Roosevelt's presentation was the key. Few of his gubernatorial fireside chats were recorded, but the texts show that FDR often included a call to action.
Democracy is you. If you are democratic, if you vote, if you participate in government, it will function. This is the secret message. It's embedded in almost all of his speeches. If the people do this, it will work.
As he did in his later presidential fireside chats, Governor Roosevelt adopted a casual, conversational style.
This isn't two-way radio. This is one-way radio. Roosevelt is speaking. But in his speaking, he is speaking in not just simple language, but also informal language. Thus, many of the fireside chats begin, "My friends." Clearly, there's a tailoring of a message going on here.
Years later, FDR revealed his method.
And he said, you know, when I gave my first fireside chat on the banking collapse, I sat in my study in the White House and, quote, had before my eyes the pictures of all those Americans with whom I was talking, end quote. This is a real actor's trick. This is the classic kind of Shakespearean actor who looks out over the audience and looks at one person in the next back row to pitch it to. Watching their face. Roosevelt can't see any face, so he imagines faces. This allows him to communicate effectively. It keeps him in the persona of the affable father figure talking directly to my friends.
A newspaper editorial published on October 17, 1930, shows that FDR was already using this technique 2 years before he became president.
If television were perfected, thousands who listened in last night would have seen their governor seated comfortably behind his big desk in the executive mansion, flashing his characteristic smile with each sally, shaking his head for emphasis over a good point. Taking his radio audience into his confidence, the governor leans forward just a little to make a scathing jibe. And turning away from the mic, the governor gives a boyish smile of, "That was a good one," to his smaller sight audience of friends and family sitting with him in the study, where radio engineers and announcers keep the lines open. Slyly taking a quote from a Republican campaign speech, he pours a bit of polished satire into the mic, leaning back, straightening his broad shoulders, and with the same grimly amused glint in his eyes and the same, well, you understand how ridiculous it is, smile, the governor pokes fun at his opponents for his unseen audience. Then he anticipates. He keeps the air still for a second, his eyes narrow, and he launches an attack. When the half hour is over, and incidentally, Governor Roosevelt is pleased as a boy when he hits the broadcast time nail exactly on the head, he settles back to talk in that same smooth, musical voice radio listeners and critics have come to admire. Albany Times Union.
Saratoga Springs, New York, February 8, 1932. I do hate to lose you as our governor, but I hope our next president will be a Democrat, and you are the one. I could not resist writing to you to express my opinion after listening to you this evening over the radio.
Once I built a railroad.
In 1932, economic conditions were quickly getting worse. Marie LaPaglia remembers the Depression's effect on her family and the Albany community.
My father was a very hard-working man. He was embarrassed. He was embarrassed to receive anything. But we were given clothes, we were given shoes, and we were fed. This is how we survived. But if you walked on Pearl Street, you saw so many people, men especially, begging for an apple or something. These were desperate times.
Brother, can you spare a dime?
Michael Barbrick.
And so they have these anxieties and these problems, and he speaks directly to the people. And he's not, I mean, he's doing this for political purposes because he wants to, you know, develop a kind of consensus around his vision of what should be done. But he's not speaking to them so much as voters, but as human beings.
And so on June 22, 1932, a man from Gloversville, New York wrote,
I am desperately in need of work, and I'm asking you if there's any possible chance of you helping me out. My wife and baby are in Johnstown, and I'm in Gville, and if I can get work, I can get my family and home together again. And God knows I want to do that and what is right.
Troy, New York, August 22nd, 1932. Dear Governor Roosevelt, I'm a married man. Got one boy, 8 years old, and not worked in some time. All I ask for is an honest living, and God will repay you. I'm up against it real bad.
Gloversville, New York, October 25th, 1932. I have read and listened to your talks, and in all, you seem so plainly understood by all. That is why I write this letter. I am a poor and almost destitute man. For the past 3 years, I have been very, very unfortunate. I have lost my home, or all the home I had. We don't want to become objects of charity. We are desperately in need and must have work if we are to live.
And so, under the auspices of the Democratic National Committee, you will now hear the Honorable Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Good evening, my friend.
On April 7th, 1932, with the presidential campaign in sight, Governor Roosevelt gave a nationwide NBC broadcast and put the Depression into terms people could easily understand.
These unhappy times call for the building up of plans that rest upon the forgotten, the unorganized, but the indispensable units of economic power. For plans like those of 1917 that build from the bottom up and not from the top down, that put their faith once more in the forgotten man at the bottom of the economic pyramid.
In his conclusion, he called upon the nation's resolve.
It is high time to get back to fundamentals. It is high time to admit with courage that we are in the midst of an emergency at least equal to that of war. Let us mobilize to meet it.
In July, FDR gave another national radio address from Albany.
In the olden days, campaigns were conducted amid surroundings of brass bands and red lights. Oratory was an appeal primarily to the emotions and sometimes to the passions. But it has always been my feeling that with the spread of education, with the wider reading of newspapers, and especially with the advent of the radio, mere oratory and mere emotion are having less to do with the determination of public questions under our representative system of government. Today, common sense plays the greater part, and final opinions are more often arrived at in the quiet of the home. In this quiet of common sense and friendliness, I want you to hear me tonight as I sit here in my own home.
Within a year, Roosevelt was in the White House, confident in his ability to win public support over the radio. One of his advisors recalled,
"We went on the theory, gained from hard experience in New York State, that people love the personal touch. They delight in believing there is a close link between them and the folk who run the show." James Farley.
During his presidency, Roosevelt continued to schedule his fireside chats to correspond with important legislative debates. As he told an advisor, "All we have to do is let the flood of mail settle on Congress, and the opposition will be beating a path to the White House door." Richard Hamm.
They were always calculated when they were given. They were given for purposes. They weren't just a regular weekly radio show, but it was always carefully crafted. These were studied scripts and studied performances. He knew how to use the media by the time he is president.
Without that unrivaled medium for reaching millions of voters, the work of overcoming the false impression created by the tons of written propaganda put up by the foes of the New Deal would have been many times greater than it was. And to be candid, it might have been an impossible job. Yet no matter what was written or what was charged, the harmful effect was largely washed away as soon as the reassuring voice of the President of the United States started coming through the ether into the family living room. James Farley.
Radio revolutionized the political process. Franklin D. Roosevelt's role in this transformation began with his gubernatorial radio addresses. In Albany, he developed the broadcasting style that forged an unusually deep emotional bond with his constituents. The Roosevelt mystique lingers today.
What Roosevelt established is that presidents have to be more responsive to people, but they also have to represent people. And that, I think, is Roosevelt's real legacy. And the real reason that he was able to effect that is because people made this connection with him through the fireside chats.
Roosevelt, people loved him. This man was rich, but he had a heart of gold for the poor people. People considered him a saint. I love that man.
Eleanor Roosevelt, who remained a public figure until her death, she said that after Roosevelt's death, people would stop her to say that they missed the way the president used to talk to them, that they felt that there had been a real dialogue between him and them, that he would talk to me about my government and what it was doing. This is a shift in the conception of government that is a part of the Roosevelt legacy. Roosevelt, by conveying what the government was doing for the people and asking the people to be part of the government, had sealed a bargain that made the national government their government and thus made it very trustworthy and important.
Live from Albany, the origins of FDR's Fireside Chats was written, narrated, and produced by Jeff Storm, graduate student in the History Department of the State University of New York at Albany. Special thanks to Richard Hamm, Michael Barbaric, Marie LaPaglia, Tony Opalka, Randy Spicer, Barbara Scott Sherry, Robert Scott, Billy Duncan, Greg McShea, Kelly Stevens, Mike Walsh, John Simmons, Jerry Zahavi, and Susan McCormick.